disappeared. And I think the point of all this being where you are now at Michigan Central is to create a world-leading center point of that.
Directly across from the renovated train station, there's a proof of concept. Detroit's old book depository building, also abandoned for decades, also restored. It reopened last year and houses an incubator of about 100 high-tech mobility startups, such as ESPE. Its CEO is Ron Butler.
I'm a former Detroit firefighter, as well as a public school teacher.
Butler sits in an office surrounded by gadgets, tools, and prototypes.
This is intelligent thinking blankets.
Just not too intelligent, I hope.
Well, we do fold in some AI.
All right.
Butler is showing a prototype blanket woven with glass fibers that can cover electric vehicles and detect failing batteries before they burst into flames.
There's no place like this. Anything we want to do, we build our own electronics boards here and test them. The specialty fire blanket was sewn downstairs.
That kind of synergy is crucial for so-called hard tech firms, which are focused on building physical things.
Our margins are always very slim. We're poor people basically trying to build things. And this place allows us to do that.
That's the big sell. There's more work to do. The campus is surrounded by a neighborhood still struggling to recover from decades of decline. The hope is that Michigan Central can be the anchor of a tech renaissance. In Detroit, I'm Novosafo for Marketplace.
We visit another Detroit landmark once considered a symbol of an era of renewal. It's the Renaissance Center, home to the headquarters of General Motors. But not for long, the company's announced it's moving to a new space. We'll take a look at lessons from that shift for Detroit and beyond tomorrow. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. We're from APM, American Public Media.
Heading up to 8 o'clock, and we're heading up to the North Bay again with Mel as we go to Santa Rosa.
12 eastbound between Farmers Lane and Mission Boulevard, slow to stop and go. It's slow from Rohnert Park toward Santa Rosa, northbound on 101 between Golf Course Drive and downtown Santa Rosa through the 12 interchange. And further south, 101 southbound between Roland Boulevard and North San Pedro Road in Novato, that's stop and go. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Murphy Mechanic Construction and Visit Modesto, offering a summer filled with nostalgia and fruit. Visitors can explore farm stands, pick fruit, and experience graffiti summer starting June 5th. More at visitmodesto.com. Summer weather on the way. Cloudy skies around the Bay Area today, mid-60s to the upper 70s. Warmer tomorrow, 80s to the upper 90s. KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento. It is 8 o'clock.
Good morning. Former President Trump's allies demand loyalty after his felony conviction in New York. What does that mean for Republican candidates who are not named Trump? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, the first big wildfire of the season near Tracy is now 75% contained.
How much power can states wield over the Internet? I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. New York State wants to keep social media algorithms away from kids. And how did Napster transform music? The music sharing site started 25 years ago. How much safer is a Ukrainian city now that its defenders can fire U.S.-made weapons into Russia? It's Monday, June 3rd. This day in 1989, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khomeini died. His government remains in power. Also in 1989, Chinese troops began crushing pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. The nation's former top infectious disease expert is testifying before a House panel this morning. Dr. Anthony Fauci helped guide the U.S. through the coronavirus pandemic. He's been heavily criticized by some Republican lawmakers. Some thought federal government policies were too strict. Others criticized theories about how the coronavirus got started. That included an allegation that Fauci influenced scientists who studied the coronavirus's origin. Fauci rejected that.
The accusation being circulated that I influenced these scientists to change their minds by bribing them with millions of dollars in grant money is absolutely false and simply preposterous. I had no input into the content of the published paper.
Democratic lawmakers say Republicans are spending too much time focusing their anger on Fauci They say they should be focused on the science and on public health. President Biden has outlined a three-phase plan to end Israel's war in Gaza. The plan has yet to be formally agreed to by Hamas or Israel. But as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, civilians in Gaza are eager to see Biden push through the deal.
The plan includes a six-week ceasefire and the possibility for Palestinians displaced from North Gaza to go back home for the first time in the war. NPR producer in Gaza, Anas Baba, spoke with Rima Al-Aqa, a mother of four currently living in a tent in Mawasi near Rafah in southern Gaza. It's a difficult life, she says, but she's hopeful about the possibility of being able to go home.
Actually, this is a dream for us, actually, to just return to our houses in the north of Gaza and to stop the war, actually, the fighting, all these things, because our bodies are very, very tired, you know, and our dream right now, actually, to stop the war and this hard life. So I hope America to do that and stop the war.
Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Beijing is pushing back after the president of the Philippines gave a weekend speech. NPR's Emily Fang reports he asserted his country's sovereignty over waters disputed with China.
China's foreign ministry hit back at the Philippines' claims over waters surrounding a collection of reefs and islands in the South China Sea. In 2016, an international tribunal ruled that those waters belong to the Philippines, not China. But China says it does not recognize the outcome of that tribunal, and its foreign ministry said in a statement the Philippines had, quote, acted in bad faith and provoked recent tensions that have seen Chinese Coast Guard ships ramming Philippines boats and blocking them from supplying sailors. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Voting in India's national elections has concluded after a six-week election process. Starting tomorrow, officials will count around 1 billion ballots. The party of incumbent Prime Minister Narendra Modi may be poised to win re-election. That would give Modi an unprecedented third term as India's leader. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. And I hope you're enjoying the relative cool, because it's about to get hot. Starting tomorrow, some inland parts of the Bay Area could reach the mid to upper 90s. The rising temperatures could melt what's left of the state's dwindling snowpack. KQED science editor Kevin Stark reports.
The Weather Service says this will be the first prolonged heat wave of the year across the West. For California, it will be felt most acutely in the Sierra Nevada in the northern part of the state, with potentially record-breaking temperatures for June. After a blissfully normal water year, the state's snowpack has dwindled to below 50%. UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain.
It's very possible the upcoming heat wave will pretty much kill off what's left.
He says that could jumpstart the state's fire season and potentially elevate the risk later on this summer. I'm Kevin Stark, KQED News.
The Marin County Board of Supervisors is scheduled to consider funding a wage increase for in-home caregivers tomorrow. KQED's Christopher Alam has more.
The tentative agreement between In-Home Supportive Services Public Authority, or IHSS, and SEIU Local 2015 would boost the hourly wage for more than 2,000 workers. That would represent a boost to $19 an hour starting in August, with 25-cent increases each year. Coupled with anticipated minimum wage increases, the Marin County executive predicts wages would hit $21 per hour by the start of 2027. The agreement also provides some incentives for workers in West Marin who may have to travel substantial distances to reach their clients. I'm Christopher Alam, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news at kqed.org.
Support for NPR on Monday comes from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR. And the listeners and members of KQED. Here's Mel with traffic on the San Mateo Bridge at 8:06.
Where we have a high wind advisory and traffic is a bit slow from Midspan out to about Delaware Street. No slowdowns, though, on the Dumbarton Bridge in San Jose, 87 northbound around Taylor Street. The right lane is blocked from debris from a previous crash. Mel Baker for KQED.
KQED News, again with Brian Watt, coming right up at 8:22 this morning. The Oakland Ballers' first home game is sold out already, which means more than 4,000 people will be showing up in West Oakland. Coming up at 8:22, a look what the Ballers are doing to encourage fans not to drive to the game. More from KQED News ahead on KQED Public Radio. Again, as reported, cooler temperatures hang on through today. Breezy daytime winds and a marine layer stratus overnight. Tomorrow, everything changes. Clearing skies, especially along the coast and bay. A heat advisory in effect for the inland areas, starting with the Bay Area through Thursday. The Sacramento Valley starts tomorrow through Thursday as well. Temperatures will moderate towards the latter part of the week. Today, Bay Area highs 60s to the upper 80s. Tomorrow, look for sun, warmer temperatures, 70s all the way to the upper 90s inland. Sacramento Valley, cloudy today, some afternoon gusts to 35, highs 80 to 88. Sunny, hotter temperatures tomorrow with highs ranging from 98, possibly to 104.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. We find out this fall how, if at all, former President Trump's criminal conviction affects his bid to return to the White House. We also find out what voters think of candidates who demonstrated their loyalty by denouncing the jury verdict. They include Kerry Lake of Arizona, one of the Republicans aiming to help their party recapture the Senate.
This will go down as a stain in American history. It's called lawfare, and it will only make Trump stronger.
How does Republicans' fealty affect them? David Wasserman is senior editor and elections analyst for the Cook Political Report, which is a nonpartisan newsletter. Welcome back to the program, sir.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Okay, help me think this through politically. If you're a Republican, what is the political calculation of publicly rejecting this jury verdict?
Well, just to set the scene, Steve, to date, most Democrats have been running ahead of Joe Biden down ballot because they have their own brands and they're more personally popular than Biden is. And in our polling in battleground states from mid-May, Trump was up 47-44 in six key battleground states, but Democratic Senate candidates were ahead, and the House ballot was tied at 44-44. And so it's been telling to see some of the reactions of these Republicans, and so far it suggests that they don't see any upside, those who are running in competitive states and districts, in telling voters to respect the verdict. To the contrary, some of them see upside in decrying what they say is the weaponization of the justice system. And this conviction might have some slight upside for down ballot Republicans, not in a major way, and it's going to take a while to gauge the impact on polling, but it sparked tremendous anger among Trump's base. And to the extent turnout is a bit higher among those supporters of Trump's, it has the potential to lift all Republican votes. Where the conviction could cost Trump is among soft independents who would be hesitant about voting for a convicted felon, but they may not change their minds down ballot.
Oh, this is really interesting. I want to try to summarize what you've told me, Dave. You're telling me that Republicans broadly are not doing as well as their presidential candidate in surveys, and so by attaching themselves more firmly to their presidential candidate, they may feel they can pull themselves up a notch on the ladder. Is that it?
And in addition, many Republican candidates and committees have gotten a fundraising boost, not as decisively as Trump has himself in the aftermath of this, but they've been able to engage that Trump base more to raise money. And keep in mind that at a candidate level, Democrats have had an advantage to date in these races, particularly in House seats, where there's been a noticeable drop-off in Republican candidate fundraising since the speakership changed.
Let me ask about one critical race, though. In Maryland, which is a blue state, Larry Hogan, the rare Republican who could plausibly win, and he is the Senate candidate there for the Republican Party, urged people to respect the verdict, which is a normal thing that would normally have happened in most circumstances in the past. And this drew a harsh reaction from the Trump campaign, saying your campaign is over. Laura Trump, the former president's daughter-in-law, now co-chair of the Republican Party, said this about Larry Hogan. Let's listen.
He doesn't deserve respect of anyone in the Republican Party at this point, and quite frankly, anybody in America.
I can think of other occasions where the president or presidential candidate would be okay if somebody in their party had to keep their distance. Why not this time?
Larry Hogan's in an extremely unique situation. He is running in a state that Joe Biden carried by more than 30 points last time. And so Hogan needs Democratic voters to get to his win number. It's unlikely he will at this point, given that the Democratic nominee, Angela Alsa Brooks, has a bit of a halo after winning the primary. But what's more telling is the reaction of Republicans in more evenly divided states and districts. We're not seeing them say the same thing that Hogan did. And it suggests that public opinion about this trial and conviction is very closely aligned to the breakdown of support in the presidential race to begin with. And the reaction of Lake, who, it's not surprising, she's one of Trump's most hardcore supporters anywhere on the Senate battlefield, it shows that she needs to get closer to Trump's number in Arizona in order to win. After all, she is running behind him at the moment.
David Wasserman is with the Cook Political Report. Thanks very much, as always, for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Take care.
Today in federal court in Delaware, jury selection begins in the Hunter Biden trial on gun charges.
This case against the president's son was brought by Justice Department Special Counsel David Weiss. Just last week, former President Trump was in the spotlight denouncing the jury verdict against him in a Democratic state. Now, trial begins for a Biden as part of an investigation that dates back to President Trump's administration.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is joining us now. Ryan, a gun case against Hunter Biden here, but what are the charges he's facing?
So there are three charges against Hunter here that all relate to a Colt Cobra revolver that he bought in October of 2018. He faces two counts of making false statements when purchasing the weapon. Prosecutors say that Hunter lied on a federal background check form he had to fill out when buying the gun. That form has a boilerplate question that asks whether you use illegal drugs or are addicted to drugs. Prosecutors say that Hunter lied on that form by checking the no box, in other words, saying that he wasn't using illegal drugs when prosecutors say he was. And then there's, of course, also the third count, and that is for the unlawful possession of a firearm by a drug user or addict.
Okay, how do prosecutors intend to prove their case?
Well, they've said in filings and in open court that they expect to call around a dozen witnesses. That includes Hunter's ex-wife, Kathleen Buell, as well as the widow of his brother, Beau, Haley Biden. Hunter had a romantic relationship with her after Beau died. Prosecutors say that Haley Biden will testify that Hunter had the gun in question, that she threw it into a dumpster outside a market in Wilmington less than 2 weeks after he bought it. That gun was later found by a man collecting recyclables. He's the one who turned it over to law enforcement. Prosecutors also intend to use parts of Hunter's own memoir as evidence, as well as Hunter's own text messages related to his drug use. But to be clear, Hunter has been very open, including in his memoir, about his addiction to crack cocaine, to alcohol. But this trial looks like it's going to put that struggle and the toll that it took on the Biden family very much in the national spotlight.
All right, now how will Hunter Biden's attorneys plan to counter the government's case?
Well, they think they can challenge some of the evidence. There has been, though, it has to be said, a lot of legal wrangling in the lead up to this trial. Hunter's attorneys have tried to get this case dismissed on a bunch of different grounds. The judge has denied those. But this time last year, it looked like Hunter was going to be able to avoid trial entirely. He had a tentative deal to plead guilty to misdemeanor tax charges and to avoid prosecution entirely on the gun charges. But that deal fell apart dramatically in court. Weeks later, Weiss was appointed special counsel. He then indicted Hunter on these gun charges. A few months after that, Weiss separately brought tax charges against Hunter in California. That case is scheduled to go to trial in September. Now, Hunter's attorney, Abby Lowell, has argued that these gun offenses are usually not charged, and he's argued that the special counsel has folded, essentially, to Republican pressure on the Hill, and that this whole prosecution is politically motivated.
There is quite the political backdrop for this trial, the son of a president going on trial as his father runs for re-election. I mean, could this possibly hurt President Biden?
Well, look, it comes at a tricky time for the president politically, of course. We're just, what, 5 months out from the election. Republicans have certainly in the past tried to play up Hunter's legal troubles, his international business dealings, in an effort to muddy his father. And there's every reason to believe that they're going to try to do that with this trial again. But Hunter, of course, is the one on trial, not President Biden. Hunter is not running for president. And of course, the man who is running against Biden for the presidency, former President Trump, was just found guilty by a jury in New York of falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to an adult film star. But Trump is still leading Biden in many polls. So it's hard to say what the political impact, if any, Hunter's legal troubles will have on his father's political fortunes. We're going to have to wait and see. Hunter's trial, though, opens today with jury selection, and this trial could last up to 2 weeks.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you.
More than 23 million low-income households are losing federal financial support for internet service. Funding has run out, and lawmakers haven't agreed on a fix. Sarah Jane Tribble with our partner KFF Health News met a woman affected at a remote ranch in southeastern Idaho.
Myrna Bronco broke her leg during the COVID pandemic. Trying to fix a shed for her horses and cows, she was standing on a ladder, pushing down on a drill, and it slipped.
And I fell, my leg got caught in those rails and busted it, and my bone was sticking out. And the only thing was holding it was my sock.
The 69-year-old arm crawled back to the house.
Why didn't you take a phone with you?
I never really dealt with phones. I never thought nothing of it.
Bronco hasn't really needed a smartphone or the internet. Her entire life is right here on the Fort Hall Reservation. For her, the most important connection has always been to this land. But things are changing. Matthew Rantanen explains.
The society has converted everything to be online. You cannot be in this society and operate without connection to broadband.
Rantanen is director of technology for the Southern California Tribal Chairmen's Association. He also runs training workshops for tribes working to get broadband on their land. Healthcare, banking, applications for jobs or benefits, they're all online.
All of those things keep Myrna at a disadvantage if she doesn't have a connection to that broadband, right?
But for the last year, Bronco has had a good internet connection with help from the subsidy. Living on tribal land, she qualifies for a $75 break, and that covers her whole bill. Those discounts ended in May. On Capitol Hill, Senator John Thune from South Dakota joined other Republicans in saying the Affordable Connectivity Program allows too many people to qualify for the discounts.
ACP does a poor job of directing support to those who truly need it.
When I asked Bronco if she could keep the internet without the subsidy, she hesitated.
I'm going to have to. It's one of my necessities.
After breaking her leg, Bronco needed 9 surgeries. She used her internet to keep track of medical records, email doctors, and to book appointments. Bronco says she may need to sign on for a slower plan to keep getting the internet. In Idaho, I'm Sarah Jane Tribble.
She's with our partner, KFF Health News. This is NPR News.
On member-supported KQED for Monday, and good morning. I'm Dave Freeman at 819. Brian Watt coming right up at 822 with your KQED News. Let's find out about traffic conditions out in the East Bay again with Mel.
In Vacaville, 80 eastbound after Allison Drive, we have a ladder in the slow lane. 37 westbound between the Mare Island Bridge and the lane merge, nearly stopped traffic right now and then slow to the raceway. And 101 southbound between Ignacio Boulevard and Central San Rafael in the Novato area, that's slow. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco SPCA, where adoption fees are waived on animals 5 months and older through June. Listeners can find a furry new friend at the Adoption Center at 250 Florida or sfspca.org. VisitorsCoverage.com offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. And you can learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO. Stay tuned for Forum coming up in under an hour at 9 o'clock. A new book considers the promise and peril of medicinal psychedelics through the lens of a retreat in the Amazon. We're going to talk with the author. That's at 9. Then at 10, the guest is former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. She talks about effective communication strategies and the importance of knowing your audience. Join the Forum audience today. Hear it at 9, 9 to 11, rebroadcast tonight on KQED Public Radio, of course. Sacramento Valley, cloudy skies today, highs 80 to 88. Hotter tomorrow as things kick in, highs 98 to 104 with a heat warning in effect tomorrow at 11. Bay Area, mostly cloudy today. The coolest day, it looks like, 60s to the upper 80s inland. Hotter tomorrow with highs in the 60s near the water to the upper 90s. Support for NPR comes from the FDA. Its Remove the Risk campaign encourages people to dispose of their unused, unwanted, and expired opioid medications in their homes. Learn more at fda.gov/removetherisk. Your part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services, yptc.com/npr. And Smart Mouth, committed to the prevention of bad breath for 24 hours with zinc ion technology. Smart Mouth products can be found nationwide at drugstores, grocery stores, and supercenters, or at smartmouth.com. And the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. The financial outlook for Bay Area transit agencies is still pretty rocky. They haven't recovered from the pandemic. And this year, state lawmakers were trying to move forward a bill for a regional tax that would have given transit a lifeline. But the proposal ultimately died. To break all of this down, we're joined by KQED's Dan Brecky. Dan, hello.
Hi, Brian.
So, you know, I take BART and buses my fair share, and I've noticed more people on them, but how bad is the financial picture of Bay Area transit agencies?
Well, you're right. People are coming back to transit, but they're coming back very slowly. BART still has fewer than 45% of the riders that it did before March 2020, and that's a big problem for that particular agency because passengers used to pay most of the bills for running the system day to day. And you see that same picture elsewhere, although most agencies like Muni and AC Transit have recovered more riders. They're in their 70 to 80% range. But overall, the recovery has been slow. And because of that, the finances of these agencies are just a mess.
And so Bay Area lawmakers proposed a bill to fund transit agencies here. And it actually got a lot of opposition from some of the agencies themselves. Why is that?
What we're talking about here is a bill that would authorize a regional vote in the nine Bay Area counties, right? That was the original idea. And in the South Bay, the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority, which is the county's only transit agency, is really dependent on sales taxes that voters down there have passed to support its operations. And some of the sales taxes are actually supporting other operations as well. For instance, BART operations in Santa Clara County. And so when they see another sales tax coming down the road, they go, wait a minute, you may be undercutting our ability to reauthorize the taxes we're depending on right now. And that same issue has emerged for some other agencies. For instance, SMART in the North Bay is facing a sales tax vote in coming years. So they're not crazy about the idea of having a competing sales tax measure on any ballot.
In what way does this outcome say something about how challenging addressing transit in the state legislature can be?
Well, it's a very difficult process. And what makes it even harder is deciding exactly what a tax measure like this would pay for. One possibility would be to simply address the huge deficits that agencies like BART and Muni are facing in the next few years. But the thinking is that voters need to have some guarantee that the system we have is going to work a lot better if they're going to sink billions of dollars into it.
You have been reporting on transit for many years. What questions has this latest story raised for you about what's next?
What we've seen in this process so far this year with the transit tax legislation is that there are some really deep local divisions about how that money should be handled. And it's not clear whether people are going to stick to those local divisions, insist on getting what they want in their locality above what might be best for the entire region, or whether there will be some spirit of compromise.
KQED's Dan Brecky, thank you.
You're welcome, Brian.
While the A's are on their way out of Oakland, the B's are on their way in. The Oakland Ballers play their first home game tomorrow at Raimondi Park in West Oakland. And as KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman reports, getting there without a car is highly encouraged.
Still a live construction site, so just be careful as you're walking through.
Crews are putting the finishing touches on the ballpark, including new parking lots.
How many parking spaces?
It's about 1,000 in total. Yeah.
That's Ballers co-founder Paul Friedman. While there's plenty of parking, the team's goal is that at least a quarter of fans will get here without a car. In upcoming seasons, the hope is that number will double. Friedman says the reasons behind their transit goals are both climate conscious and practical.
We've been told by people who do parking and transportation management for the city that if we didn't do anything, it could be as many as, 80 to 90% of people would drive.
Translation? Traffic. Friedman says he's met with neighborhood groups about that.
And we heard tremendous excitement about the idea of activating this park with baseball. And then, concerns about parking and transportation and traffic. And, the best way to solve those problems is to encourage people to use other methods.
The city has repaved the streets and sidewalks around Raimondi and removed out-of-use train tracks to make it easier to get around on two wheels or on foot. On game days, the Ballers are running a free shuttle service to the ballpark from West Oakland BART, a distance of nearly a mile. The team's also providing a free bike and scooter valet, and they're encouraging people to use AC Transit. A few blocks away from Raimondi is Kilovolt Coffee. Andrea Malaya is the manager, and she takes the bus to work.
I'd say plan time wisely, because sometimes things get kind of dicey as far as buses even like arriving on schedule.
There are four AC Transit routes that will get you within walking distance of the ballpark. But riders like Malaya could be waiting for a bus 15 minutes to a half hour, depending on the day.
I really think that there just needs to be a lot of, an increase in routes and service if people are going to find that option to even be viable or appealing.
Brian Culbertson is a traffic safety advocate, and he lives in the neighborhood around Raimondi Park. He says whether people walk or bike to the game is going to be based on safety.
If you have a lot of people on game day driving here, then you have a lot more people with cars interacting with people walking and biking.
He says as the neighborhood sees an influx of people, the city needs to redesign streets in ways that make it harder for drivers to speed. Speeding accounts for a quarter of deadly crashes in Oakland.
The area should be at least traffic calmed enough so that people walking and biking feel safe around an impatient driver who's trying to get to a game.
The Ballers' home opener is sold out. And that means 4,000 people are heading to Raimondi one way or another. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt, planning to try to take the bus to the game tomorrow night. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Some people are heading out. Traffic driving in Fremont. Here's Mel at 829.
And on the Dumbarton Bridge there, 84 westbound, just after 880, there's a large package or luggage blocking the left lane. No problems on the San Mateo Bridge, although there is a high wind advisory there. The Guadalupe Parkway, that's Highway 87 northbound in San Jose before West Taylor. Debris from a two-car crash is still blocking the right lane. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from the California Academy of Sciences. From redwood forests to deserts, breathtaking coasts to bustling cities, visitors can be inspired at California State of Nature, a new exhibit. CalAcademy.org for tickets. Genentech, a science-driven biotech company, helping to transform how complex health problems are treated. Learn how Genentech is tackling some of the biggest questions in healthcare at gene.com/askbiggerquestions.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Biden's son Hunter is on trial on federal gun charges in Delaware. First Lady Jill Biden accompanied her stepson to court this morning for jury selection. Hunter Biden is accused of failing to disclose his drug addiction history on federal gun purchase forms. The defendant claims he's being unfairly targeted because of election year politics. Hunter Biden's trial began just days after former President Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial in New York ended with a conviction on 34 felony counts. The White House has issued a statement in which President Biden congratulates Mexican President-elect Claudia Sheinbaum. A rally last night after Sheinbaum's projected win as the first woman in Mexico to be elected president. The U.S. is renewing its pressure on Israel and Hamas to end their war in Gaza. Last Friday, President Biden went public with a ceasefire proposal Israel offered behind closed doors. But NPR's Daniel Estrin reports division remains within the Israeli government.
Hamas says it's ready to deal with the proposal positively and constructively. President Biden is promising Hamas what it essentially has been asking for all along, which is a guaranteed and permanent end of the war. The bigger question is if Israel is ready to get on board.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 224 points or more than 0.5%. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. State fire officials say yesterday slowdown in the wind and milder weather helped fire crews make progress in containing the Corral fire near Tracy. The fire grew quickly on Saturday due to gusts of up to 45 miles an hour. Nathan Rick is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Sacramento.
In the evenings, we typically get the Delta breeze going, and then there's some terrain, you know, just to the east of that San Jose area. And so you get some of that downsloping to increase those winds, and then that just kind of contributes to stronger winds that we saw last night.
The fire pushed scores of families from their homes, destroyed one home, injured two firefighters, and burned more than 14,000 acres. CAL FIRE says it's 75% contained. The arraignment of three City of Alameda police officers charged with involuntary manslaughter in the 2021 death of Oakland resident Mario Gonzalez was postponed last week because one of the officers is living in South Africa. The Alameda County Superior Court approved the two-month postponement to give Officer Eric McKinley time to move his family back to the Bay Area and defend himself in court. Allison Barry Wilkinson is an attorney for one of the officers. She says Officer McKinley went to South Africa last December to work as a missionary.
Everyone would like this case to proceed forward expeditiously, but the circumstances were such that everyone was in agreement.
If convicted, the officers face up to 4 years in prison. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support today comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Last year, the U.S. Surgeon General issued a warning about the effects of social media on children's mental health. Coming up on Morning Edition, we'll hear from New York Governor Kathy Hochul about her push to pass bills to protect kids online. And later this hour...
On the next California Report, school board members across the state are facing recall elections after receiving backlash for enacting trans notification policies and restricting the use of certain flags on campuses. I'm Madi Bolaños. More on that next time on the California Report.
Hear it at 8:51 a.m. Support for NPR comes from Schwab, with Schwab investing themes like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, or pet passion. Over 40 themes to invest in. Learn more at schwab.com. Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners of KQED Public Radio. Morning Edition, the California Report, Forum all ahead. It's now 8:35.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Another state is making a bid at regulating the global business of the Internet. Texas and Florida made an effort now before the Supreme Court to force social media companies to carry content they object to. Now, New York State is moving to legislate social media for kids. The U.S. Surgeon General last year issued a warning about the mental health risks of social media for kids, and now Governor Kathy Hochul is leading a push to limit the use of social media algorithms on kids in New York.
Our first bill is called the Save for Kids Act, which will restrict these addictive features on social media, tell the companies that they have a responsibility to monitor the content. You're not able to just keep sending the content. It has to be welcomed by the young people. They have to want this, and to find other ways to get them information. We're not banning young people from social media. Not at all. We're simply saying that they should not be bombarded with these feeds that can be sorted a different way and not in a way that is so negative for them.
I'm trying to figure out how that works in practice. If you pick something like Instagram, which I'm on, I mean, I get a bunch of things from people that I follow. There's a particular algorithm. It may also suggest things for me to look at. What would you force Instagram to change if they're going to do business in New York State?
For young people, instead of this algorithmic feed, minors would receive a feed where updates from other users they follow are sorted chronologically or in some other way that's not relying on their personal information. That it's just a different group of individuals under age 18 that you cannot use the normal business practice of continuing to send information that is unsolicited.
And how do you determine that it is a young person under a certain age who is using the phone at that point?
Well, that's exactly what we're focused on, because it's easy to evade. But, you know, for example, young people are not able to go to online gambling sites. There are ways to restrict based on not just age, but other information that I think is essential, that this information be provided, that we know who the young people are, that the companies know who they are, and they'll be held responsible if they continue the practices that they're on right now.
Does somebody have to provide an ID?
We're working on exactly how we would make that happen.
I think this is a point of debate, though, isn't it? That when you begin saying, I need an ID requirement, the people who object are not necessarily parents of kids, but other people who will say, I want to be on the internet and doing what I'm doing, and I don't want to have to show my ID because that's really intrusive for me.
I'm talking about protecting young people, teenagers, who should not be subjected to information that is negative, that is having a detrimental effect on their mental health. And we have to figure out a way, and we're smart enough to do this. And I know the companies know how to do this. Some of them are being cooperative, and others just want to continue their business practice because it's about commercial profit and gain for them. And they should not be collecting and selling personal information from young people.
Do companies, when you talk with them, raise another objection, that they're a global business, they're a national business, and it is difficult for them if every single state has its own particular regulations?
Well, I would say this, it does call for a federal response. That's the way I believe that this should occur. But in the absence of this level of responsibility, if you talk to the CEOs of these companies, they know what they're doing. They don't let their own children engage in these social media sites until they're much older. So why is everyone else having to be subjected to this? And they know how to stop this. So we're saying, come to the table, work with us. You know, we're not hostile to tech here in the state of New York. We are very pro-tech. And social media has an incredible side that is very positive. I'm talking about the fact that I, as the leader of this state, cannot ignore the signs of distress and trauma among our young people. And it's definitely correlated to what is happening with these social media feeds. And we have to do something and not just say, well, it's too hard to do, therefore we won't.
Governor Kathy Hochul of New York, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
For the last month, Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, has faced near daily strikes from Russia. The border is about 20 miles away. A change in U.S. policy could make it safer for now, but did the change come too late? NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kharkiv.
The day Russian bombs hit the home improvement center where Victoria Kitsenko works, she was reviewing orders for wallpaper. She felt a hot blast. The roof caved in. She wiped blood off her face as she forced her way outside. In the parking lot, she saw the bodies of her coworkers and a thick black plume of smoke rising over her hometown.
What's happening in Kharkiv now? It's just destruction, destruction of the city and destruction of Kharkiv's citizens. The Russians want our city, an empty city.
After nearly a month of escalating Russian attacks on Kharkiv, the White House said last week that it will allow Ukraine to fire some U.S.-provided weapons into Russia, but only across the border from the Kharkiv region. In the Saltivka neighborhood, not far from the home improvement store that was hit, Svetlana Poznikina says she's waiting to see if it will make a difference.
It's very bad here right now. A lot of people have left the neighborhood, half the houses are empty. In my apartment building, it's only retirees who have run out of money and have nowhere to go.
Poznikina, who is 55 and works in a candy store, says her blue-collar neighborhood has long been in the line of fire. Russian forces pummeled Saltivka's high-rises, markets, and parks as they tried to occupy Kharkiv at the beginning of the full-scale invasion in 2022. And they have struck it repeatedly after launching a new offensive in the Kharkiv region last month. Poznikina says that Western words of support have not seemed to have translated into protection from the bombs.
The longer there's delay in weapons or action, the more the fighting seems to increase and the more missiles are launched at us. So we feel abandoned.
Another Saltivka resident, 31-year-old Tatiana Kovalenko, says the Russian strikes have not stopped since the U.S. allowed Ukraine to strike Russia with Western weapons. It's restless here, very restless, she says. They hit us everywhere. We live on the 16th floor, so we can see what comes in and where it hits. She's 8 months pregnant. She says she and her family spend every night in the bomb shelter. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has brought up Kharkiv repeatedly when pleading with the U.S. and other allies to give Ukrainian troops more leverage in using Western weapons. In Singapore this weekend, Zelensky said he's seeking the use of long-range weapons like ATACMS to hit Russian military targets currently beyond their reach.
So they have these weapons there and they do not remove them because they know that Ukraine cannot target them with Western weaponry, even if they fire against us.
Back in Saltivka, there's a memorial at what's left of the Home Improvement Center. 19 people were killed here, including Victoria Kitsenko's boss. Kitsenko says she was so shaken by the attack that she has now left Kharkiv. She is not sure she will return. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kharkiv.
This is NPR News.
Traffic news now with Mel Baker coming up at 8:43.
In Pleasanton, 680 southbound before Sunol Boulevard, a box truck and Tesla accident in the left lane. Traffic is stop and go back to the Dublin interchange. 880 northbound before High Street, back up to Hagenberger, a hit and run crash on the right hand shoulder. And 880 northbound before the Alameda in San Jose, hit and run crash there also on the shoulder. Traffic slow back to Bascom Avenue. Mel Baker for KQED.
Where do our lost things go, and will we meet them again in this life or the next? Now, a Monday perspective from listener Paul Staley.
If there is an afterlife, I have a request. Of course, I want to see all the people I've loved who have passed on before me, but I'd also like a reunion with all the things I've lost along the way. We'll need a pretty big room. There'll be a big mound of golf balls, and a large assortment of unmatched socks, hats, clothing, sunglasses, keys. The list of invitees will be long. These were all things that at one time were possessions of mine, although my grip proved not that tight. Their hold on me, however, was never stronger than when I couldn't find them. It'll be an emotional occasion. I still miss some of them, and I imagine there'll be hard feelings on their part. Why wasn't I more careful, less absent-minded? I'll tell them how much I beat myself up about their disappearance, but in the end, that can't change the outcome. I will ask what happened after we parted ways. Perhaps they wound up belonging to somebody who took better care of them. I hope so. I'd hate to think of all of them heading straight to a landfill. Our relationship was always a two-way street. Yes, I got use out of them, but it was me who released them from the limbo of inventory and gave them a role in the world. But in the end, there will be no avoiding this awkward question. Did I ever replace them? For some, the answer will be yes, and I hope that answer is taken as evidence of their importance and not an indication that they are mere commodities. For the rest, there may be a brief surge of pride that comes from being labeled irreplaceable. And that could soon be followed by this troubling thought. Perhaps I decided that I didn't really need them. Possession, after all, is often the result of appetite and desire and not necessity. And this reckoning of whether you need something or merely like it is something that ought to be done in this life and not in whatever comes next. With a perspective, this is Paul Staley.
Paul Staley lives in San Francisco. You can hear more stories like Paul's on our podcast. Just search KQED's Perspectives on your favorite podcast app. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and digital equity initiatives to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Ahead on KQED in Morning Edition, Ukraine's president alleges China is helping Russia to undermine a global peace summit as he turns to Asian nations to help in ending a war. That's coming right up on KQED. California Report with Monte Bolaños, reporting this morning from San Francisco and Forum. Get ready for Forum 9 to 11 today, rebroadcast 8 to 10 tonight. Cloudy skies today, generally along the Bay Area. The coolest day today, mid-60s to the upper 80s are forecast. Mostly sunny tomorrow, warm to hot, highs in the 70s to the upper 90s far inland. Sacramento Valley with a heat warning starting tomorrow. Look for highs 80 to 88 today, 98 to 104 possibly tomorrow. Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Singapore over the weekend trying to rally support for a global peace conference he's organizing in Switzerland. But one powerful Asian country is likely not attending, and that's China. NPR's Emily Fang was in Singapore as well following all of this. Emily, Zelensky wants countries in Asia to attend a Swiss peace conference, but he called out China in particular. What did he say?
He came up pretty strongly against China. He was in Singapore for this defense summit over the weekend, and his words were a pretty big contrast when you consider China was once Ukraine's biggest trading partner before Russia's full-scale invasion 2 years ago. So Zelensky said he'd been unable to get a meeting with Chinese officials who were in Singapore. China says it's neutral on this war. But then Zelensky alleged this. He said, quote, Russia, using Chinese influence in the region, is using Chinese diplomats and does everything it can to disrupt the peace summit. And he said this is unfortunate that such a, quote, big, independent, powerful country as China is an instrument in the hands of Vladimir Putin, Russia's leader. Zelensky also said China was helping to block other countries from attending the summit, though he did not offer details on exactly how.
Wow. Okay. So how did China respond then?
China's foreign ministry today totally denied this. They said they were an impartial party to this conflict, but they've already signaled they are not going to come to the peace summit because Russia is not invited. And I asked several Chinese military officials at this defense summit about why. One said they felt without Russia, the summit just felt like this one-sided exercise to rile up international politics. And here's another official, Senior Colonel Zhang Qi, who teaches at the Military National Defense College in Beijing. He says China has put forth numerous peace proposals, but it is the U.S. and other large countries that are provoking and fanning the flames of more tension. Now, many countries would disagree with this, but it shows how even with conflicts happening far away from Asia, in the Middle East, in Ukraine and Russia, Asian countries, where I'm based, feel impacted, and they're being called on to choose a side, including in the U.S.-China rivalry that runs through many of these conflicts.
And I understand the issue of Taiwan came up quite a bit during this security conference this weekend as well, and China's defense minister spoke out very strongly against international support for Taiwan.
Yeah, so China just had these big military drills around Taiwan, and China's defense minister delivered an address condemning all of Taiwan's leadership, warning that China was prepared to act if, per its account, there is what he calls more foreign interference encouraging Taiwanese independence. But China was also trying to turn down the temperature, and Chinese military officials at this defense summit I was at said they thought his pretty fiery speech was actually a signal that China does not want to fight over Taiwan. Here's Major General Xu Hui, who is president of the International Defense Studies Department at China's National Defense University. So she says to maintain the One China principle, that basically Taiwan is part of China, that's the only way East Asian peace can be maintained, and they would like to see the U.S.'s behavior match its rhetoric. But the problem is, these are demands that are mostly unacceptable to Taiwanese society, so there's a high likelihood tensions are only going to worsen rather than calm down.
NPR's Emily Fang. Thanks a lot, Emily.
Thanks, A.
This is NPR News.
Just ahead, the California Report, after we find out about traffic in Mountain View.
85 northbound before El Camino Real. The left lane, the fast lane, is blocked by a two-car crash. Nonetheless, traffic is stopped back to 280. 101 northbound between 3rd Street and the Hospital Curve in San Francisco. Be prepared for stop-and-go traffic. Across the Bay Bridge, the backup is pretty much gone, just into the parking lot. Slow in stretches across the span into San Francisco all the way to the Central Freeway. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Sutter Health. With over 3.2 million online appointments and more than 860,000 video visits just last year, Sutter never stops making patients' lives easier. Learn more at sutterhealth.org. And support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, the Kia EV9, an all-electric three-row SUV with an onboard power generator that turns the EV9 into a mobile power source. More at kia.com.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Madi Bolaños in San Francisco, and today we're devoting the whole show to school boards. Here, I'll explain. Republicans in California have struggled to gain power at the state capitol, but they've found more success recently on school boards. Conservatives have made gains in these local seats, but now they're facing pushback in the form of recall elections, including two underway right now in Riverside County and the Bay Area. KQED's Guy Maserati is here to tell us more. Hey, Guy.
Hey, Madi.
So what are the issues driving these recall campaigns?
I think stepping back, just school boards, we've seen them become highly politicized across the country and in California, despite nominally being a nonpartisan office. But we've seen conservatives win seats on school boards and then pass policies at that local level that they could not get passed statewide. Things like restrictions on flags in response to efforts to fly the pride flag, things like transgender reporting policies, requiring teachers to tell the students' parents when the kid asks to be identified with a name or with a pronoun that's different than that's on their birth certificate. And these board trustees will say, like, this is the platform that we ran on, but those policies have definitely angered a lot of parents, residents, teachers, and now we're seeing organized pushback in the form of these recall elections. It started in March this year. We saw two conservative board members recalled in Orange County, another outside of Sacramento, and now we have two recall elections coming up. There's one in Sonol on the outskirts of the Bay Area, and another that's happening this week in Temecula, and my colleague Madison Amen at KVCR has been following that.
More than 100 people gathered on a busy street corner in Temecula one recent Saturday morning to defend Joseph Komorowski. He was there too, in his cowboy hat and boots. He waved a vote no on the recall sign. Other signs demanded protection for parental rights. That's an idea Komorowski says is central to his mission.
Parental rights is they have the authority over their children, not a school, not a county, not the state, not the United States. It's a God-given right.
To that end, since the board appointed him as president, Komorowski has pushed controversial measures like banning critical race theory, something that was never taught in the district. He championed a policy to require schools to notify parents if their child identifies as transgender. He says his policies all have the same goal.
If I were to boil down my message all into one, protecting innocence of children.
Under Komorowski, the board also gave itself broad powers to ban books it deems obscene.
He, you know, stands up for the rights that we believe in.
That's Vicky Koppel, who was at the rally and sums up what a lot of his supporters say.
We don't want boys in the girls' bathrooms or locker rooms, and we want him to represent us.
Meanwhile, others want Komorowski out.
I'm here about the recall election. Do you know about the recall election?
A group of parents, teachers, and community members with a PAC called One Temecula Valley has spent months knocking on doors to get people to mark yes on their recall ballots.
Are you mailing it in or dropping it off? You're mailing it off. Perfect.
The PAC had wanted to recall all three conservative Temecula school board members, but they only got enough signatures for Komorowski. Jeff Pack, who helps lead One Temecula Valley, says that's okay because Komorowski has whipped up a firestorm.
His demeanor and behavior, it's just, it no way fits the position, and you can see the damage being done on day one.
Pack says he wants to, quote, make Temecula boring again. And by getting Komorowski off the board,
most of the radical stuff won't happen.
Many teachers in the district say that radical stuff has made it hard to teach. Susan Allen has lived in Temecula for years and works at an elementary school.
I worry for my teacher friends that are looking over their shoulder. They're afraid what to say in their classroom.
Whether Komorowski keeps or loses his position, three other seats on the board are up for election in November. People on both sides of the recall say they expect the vote tomorrow will be a good predictor of how those races will go. It could be a while before Temecula is boring again. For the California Report, I'm Madison Ament in Temecula.
And Guy Maserati is still with us. Guy, is this trend of recalling conservative school board members something new?
Yeah, I mean, there have been recalls in the past, but I do think the quick succession of these elections, the fact that they touch on a lot of similar issues, you know, that critics say are harming LGBTQ students, it does make it feel a little bit different. And I also think it's worth noting that, you know, we've seen a rise of high-profile recalls in recent years in California, but they've largely been to remove Democrats and remove progressives like Gavin Newsom, liberal district attorneys, even the school board members who were recalled in San Francisco. The fact that these recalls are going after conservative board members is kind of that dynamic flipping.
And who do you see driving these recalls?
Well, we've seen parents organizing with teachers like you heard in Temecula, sometimes with the financial help from the unions that represent the teachers. And I talked to David Goldberg, who's president of the California Teachers Association. And basically, I asked him, like, why not just contest these seats at the next regularly scheduled election?
If you're a student in high school and you have policies actively targeting you and your humanity, that's your entire high school career. You don't get to wait another 4 years and say, don't worry.
Now, conservatives see this differently. They say this is simply a case of powerful unions who did not like recent election results, didn't like who ended up on the school board, and are now trying to engineer a different result in special elections.
So, Guy, what are your big takeaways from your reporting on this?
Well, I think this, you know, organized pushback that we're seeing to these conservative board members was not necessarily a given a year ago. There were a lot of questions about how opponents of these board members were going to respond. We'll have to see how the results shake out in Temecula this week and in Sonol next month. But I do think regardless of the results, it's clear that opponents of these conservative board members have had a bit of a wake-up call. You know, they're now vowing to take these school board seats more seriously, contest them in general elections. And oh, by the way, Republican officials I talked to said they're just as committed to winning these seats in the future. So I think you can expect this fight to continue, perhaps escalate as we move towards November.
That's KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati. Guy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Madi.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at Irvine.org. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and adult and children's health systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery, on the web at SchmidtOcean.org.
And that's the California Report for Monday, June 3rd. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Madi Bolaño.